Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Already a couple of weeks since the last episode published. Some of you regular listeners may have noticed that I've slowed down the rate of publication. I think I mentioned that in one of the previous episodes. Essentially, and I mean nothing too complicated. Essentially, I'm pretty busy with a day job. As I mentioned in another episode, if you're just catching up now, I'm now heading the strategy team at a creative technology studio called Rehab Studio here in London. We work a lot with clients, both in London as well as in the US, particularly Google, one of our largest clients. We work with many different departments at Google on a number of different projects that I unfortunately can't really be talking about. In any case, I still keep recording and having conversations with a variety of different strategists, just committed to publishing more like twice a month, three if I can manage to get there, but at least twice a month. We'll see about weekly, but I think there's a bunch of different things going on at the moment. I'm maintaining the weekly newsletter. If ever you are not familiar with the newsletter and you'd like to check it out, that's something that you can subscribe to and you'll get it every Sunday. It's the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter. You can go and check out my website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. It's everything spelled out, ice cream for everyone, like the cream ice cream, rather than me screaming at you like I'm not screaming right now, but I could be. All right. Well, what's been going on? So a little bit more news in the last couple of weeks. I'm just coming back from a fabulous week on a dude ranch. I didn't even know that was a word before going there, but I thought it was just a normal ranch. But I found out that apparently a dude ranch is more of a horse riding resort type place for the vacations, holidays, whereas a cattle ranch, an actual ranch, is, still working as a working ranch is raising cattle. And that's the main difference as far as I understand it. So that was the White Stallion Ranch near Tucson, Arizona. And it was amazing. I was doing a course all about structural, as in body language, all about body language part of the time and the rest of the time horse riding, and went hiking on the scrambling up the mountain that was nearby. And it's right by the Saguaro National Park with all the big cacti. A bunch of different types of cacti in the Arizona desert. And it was an amazing time. Really, really great week. Fantastic week. What else has been going on? It's getting cold here in London. I had a nice sunny week in Arizona. Fortunately, I've got a couple of other holidays lined up. That's nice. And I'm even investigating to go back skiing at the moment. I haven't skied since I was like a kid going on a 3-week-long school trip with school. And I've always had it to go learn again and, spend more time skiing because I remember really enjoying it as a kid and just been always going to the bottom of the list. And it turns out that we're not really doing a big family Christmas this year as we usually do. So I've been looking at doing something else and I may well go skiing in the Alps between Christmas and New Year. So so I'm looking at that too. Pretty busy with work, as I said otherwise. And now on to today's podcast episode. We have an exciting guest today. It's been a little while since I recorded, but I mean, it's still a very, very current conversation. Kim McKenzie is my guest today. Kim is a freelance strategist in New York. I got in touch with her via a Facebook group. We have an account planning and strategy Facebook group with several thousand people from all around the world. And I found out about Kim and the fact that she started this Ladies Who Strategize Slack group. For those who don't know, Slack is a collaborative instant messaging tool where you can share files and chat together with groups of people. So there's a lot of companies that use it. Well, actually, my company uses it as well. But a lot of interest groups. And it's a private instant messaging group and application, which finds out to be a lot more practical than having a group on, say WhatsApp or something. And I think she has several hundred members now, if I remember correctly, over 300 members, even though it only been started back in August or September. So it's quite recent, but it's been growing. And as the name says it, as the name pretty much spells it out, it's a Slack group and an instant messaging collaborative group for all the ladies who strategize, who work around communication strategy, brand strategy, marketing strategy, any kind of creative strategy. If you have strategy in your title, basically you can apply for it. You have to fill in a form, and otherwise Kim talks about it in more detail. And we had a really fun conversation. Kim studied cinema and media studies back in New Zealand, where she spent time and studied over there. So there's a bunch of great stories from the different studies that she did and all the different films that are her inspiration. And I enjoy cinema as well and studied cinema as well, even though I didn't remember it. I don't remember it as much as she does, I have to say. But yeah, we had a fantastic conversation. I hope you had fun. Another thing, before I let you listen to the rest of the episode, I'd like to say it makes a hell of a difference if you take a few minutes and give the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast a review or a rating on the iTunes podcast application, or that's the iPhone podcast application, the native podcast application. If you have an iPhone, you're probably using it, or you go on your computer onto iTunes and type in Ice Cream for Everyone and leave us a rating, a review. Just a few words, like if you're enjoying it, it'd be amazing because it really helps a lot of other people find the podcast. And I would also read your review at the beginning of an episode. And one of the reasons I'm not doing that now is quite simply that I don't have new reviews. I'd love to have new reviews. If you can take a minute, write a review, to thank me. I mean, if you enjoy, of course, but it makes a hell of a difference. One, because I get to hear that people are appreciating the show and encourages me to do more. Because believe it or not, this takes quite a bit of my time. And while I really enjoy the conversations I'm having, the editing and everything else, like just a little thumbs up and a little word of encouragement from you guys who are listening makes a hell of a difference for me. And it really helps other people find the show in iTunes or the iPhone podcasting app as well. So that makes a hell of a difference. Now, without further ado, here's Kim McKenzie, freelance strategist in New York and founder of the Lady Who Strategized group. Enjoy. Kim, welcome to the show.
Hello, Willem. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for taking the time for this. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It should be fun.
Oh, ditto.
Yeah. And it's just, I'm really just getting back into the flow of the new kind of like season of the podcast. And I'm, you know, it's great to have you as one of the first people, to start the new season in September, basically. So just getting into the swing of things after getting used to my new permanent role. And I was looking around. So as I was just telling before we started, hit the record button, as it were, that because of new obligations, I'm having a little bit less time to prepare. But it's not necessarily a bad thing because, you know, it's a little bit more spontaneity in the interviews as well.
I'm really flattered that you asked. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, I think the main thing basically was just we're commenting off of a thread on the Account Planners group on Facebook. And you mentioned the Ladies Who Strategize group, which is a Slack group, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So where did that start? When did that start?
About a month ago.
Oh, that's really recent. Cool.
Yeah. I've been kind of, I was in between contracts. I freelance and just kind of, I guess, feeling a little bit bored. And there were some other Slack groups that were online that I'd heard about, tried to get invites to them, failed. And I started to notice that a lot of other Slack groups I saw, and when I say a lot of maybe two or three, that when people were asking for invites, it was primarily guys. Mm. And then there would be two women who would be like, me, please. Yeah. And I kind of looked at that and I went, well, most strategy groups or, you know, agencies that I've worked with, strategy teams, either it's been 50-50 or it's been much more skewed towards women.
Right.
This doesn't make any sense. And so I just started up the Slack group on a whim, put it up on a bunch of different Facebook groups, LinkedIn groups, and it exploded. It just seemingly overnight. And what was really extraordinary about it were nearly 350 members.
Okay, cool.
And what's really extraordinary is that we went from just a handful of people in New York to tons of people in Chicago, to tons of people in LA, to tons of people in Amsterdam and China and Japan and Southeast Asia. And we had two women from Ecuador who applied last night. Yeah. And now it's going around Spain, so it's all word of mouth.
So is there a particular criteria? I mean, it says so in the title probably, but anybody who aspires, any women who aspire who are strategists, particularly in the communications industry, or what's the criteria for?
So I have a type form, which is it's sort of like a online application because it got to the stage of it's just when you say strategy, it can be a very, very gray area. And yeah. a lot of jobs and professions out there do utilize strategy in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So the way that the type form works is if the primary role of what you do is strategy, and if you're a woman, boom, you're in.
Okay.
If you're a lady and maybe you do marketing, but not necessarily strategy, then I forward people to another Slack group that's just for women professionals and called Ladies Get Paid. And we didn't know each other when we came up with our names. Our Slack group. So yeah, that's a primary thing. And we've got content strategists, environmental strategists, innovation strategists, you name it, we've got at least two, but everyone in the group is a strategist.
Well, that's cool. And how are you finding? So I'm still fairly recent to Slack, I guess. I mean, I've been using it for a few years, but the main two reasons were there's a group of friends who participated in another podcast in French, and we were using Slack. And at some point gave up because actually we found that we were all just converging regularly back to Facebook. And then like more or less kind of gave up the planning on Slack. And right now I'm using it a lot on for work, but I haven't gone around to using any public groups yet. So I was wondering how you're finding the instant messaging, like managing a group of several hundred people on there. Is it like crazy amounts of channel and lots of chatter? Is it?
There's a lot of chatter in different channels. Yeah. And so like the general one is the sort of introductions. So we have a really steady stream of introductions. The content, we have a content strategy channel. Mm. Tons of content strategists in there talking about taxonomies and stuff that I have no idea what it actually is. As different conversations have arisen, I'm the only one that can create a channel because it was kind of pandemonium there for a little while.
Yeah.
So we've got all sort of the major streams of conversation that you'd expect in any kind of forum represented. And then, for instance, quite often members will just say, "Hey, I'm a mom. I'd really like a channel for mom strategists." And then that happens. And then tons of moms go onto the channel. And obviously I'm not a mother myself, so I wouldn't even know.
Yeah.
So people just suggest it. And if it's warranted, then of course I'll just open it up.
Great. So the women who are interested, they just Google Ladies Who Strategize, or on your, where do they find the group, or where do they find you?
Word of mouth. Like okay. I said before, like I
but like they're listening to this podcast, for example, let's say.
Yeah. I hope that we get lots of applications to the podcast.
So they, sure but they, if they so. Find, they, do they Google Ladies Who Strategize and then find the Slack group through that? Or how does it, or just
no.
have to totally Google, it's a secret, just like, have to go and find it.
Yeah. And, okay. What I've started to do after the first couple days of getting like these floods of applications and emails, I started asking women, okay, if there's other women that you're working with who are strategists or strategists who've worked in the past, can you forward this email or this application to them?
Got it.
This is just pure word of mouth, pay it forward.
Okay.
And it's beautifully. So we have like these Fantastic. Sort of webs, you know, in different cities and different agencies, cool. which is really cool.
Well, that's brilliant. Okay, cool. And I mean, I think it's a fantastic initiative. And I love any kind of initiatives that are bringing the community and creating community around strategists. Mm. And in particular, well, I mean, I'm not necessarily looking after women, but it's awesome that there's resources for women in particular as well. And as we've talked about the last, you know, few months, there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of news around women in particular, because we got in contact also about the episode of the conversation recorded with Cindy Gallup, who like does a lot and talks out loud about like, you know, the position and well, basically having more women represented in higher levels of exec power. And I mean, it's all very important to have more women talking and more women empowered to be able to participate in the conversation and at all levels, at wherever level they want to be participating, working, etc. So. It's not very eloquent, but anyway, we get the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's also kind of crazy because I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
I thought that I was the only strategist out there who was like, man, if only there was some group that was women strategists where I could ask questions and get feedback and ask them about tools or, you know, if they worked in an agency that I really wanted to work with that I could have some sort of immediate warm introduction to.
Yeah.
And I've just been astonished at how many women have said the exact same thing mirrored back to me before I even opened my mouth, saying like, I've been wanting this for so long. And it's just been kind of crazy that it hasn't existed before.
Here
it is.
Yeah. There's been several different shapes and forms in the past. I mean, I know, do you know the planner survey that Heather Lefevre started?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, Heather, it started with like not a question of community, but a question of salary specifically on her side. And like, am I paid enough and fairly as a woman? And that's how it started. It snowballed from there and took on a big, so, but there's still a lot of space and a lot of opportunities to create groups and communities, which is great. Cool. All right. So let's talk a bit more about you. So you're from the States, right? Because you spend a lot of time in New Zealand, but you're not from over there, or are you from over there?
No, I'm not from New Zealand. I grew up in State College, Pennsylvania, which is Penn State University, which is very much a football town and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then I did my undergrad in Maryland at Washington College, which is a tiny, tiny liberal arts school, and did a lot with film studies and a lot with creative writing. Yeah. And
definitely wanted to talk about that because I studied cinema as well in Paris.
Really?
Yeah, I did. But I mean, I feel like just from reading a couple of details about your thesis, I'm looking for, I'm going to ask you about that. But it felt like you've probably done a lot more than I have. I was probably just going to the cinema and, you know, like slacking off probably most of the time. So it seems like you wrote a really interesting thesis during your studies about David Cronenberg and Woody Allen movies. So would you be able to tell us a little bit more about it?
Not to sound like a total wanker, but I actually wrote two theses.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so I mean, this is confirming my theory of me being a slacker in my school. So,
so my undergrad one, I wrote about David Cronenberg and Woody Allen, and how they treat women and relationships in their films. And I went into the project thinking, okay, David Cronenberg seems like a very forward-thinking, very cerebral, highbrow, lowbrow filmmaker. He's probably going to have relationships that are going to be really extraordinarily complex, and women will probably come out on top. Whereas Woody Allen is notorious for having women who are very two-dimensional in his films. I mean, even Annie Hall, it's, you know, it's very, very entertaining, but it's not like the women in there are very well-rounded. And what I came to the conclusion about, God, this is probably about like 15 years ago, was that both of them actually treat women very similarly and relationships very similarly. And that was, in a lot of ways, quite shocking to me because this is probably like 2003. So it was really before this sort of like third wave of feminism. Mm. And so I was really slowly but surely putting the pieces together of, wow, women aren't represented very well on film, which we all like, there's so much dialogue and so much written about that these days. But at that point, it really wasn't, you know, spoken about in pop culture as a whole. Yeah.
How did you choose David Cronenberg and Woody Allen? Where did you come up with the idea that there might be differences or similarities that were worth looking at together?
I got into David Cronenberg. I went to film school for a year in Australia.
Yeah.
And I studied abroad there for a year, and the film studies professor and I really hit it off. I was incredibly excited to be in his classes. I went over there thinking I would be a filmmaker. Quickly discovered I just wasn't a filmmaker and just didn't have the chops for it. But the two classes that I did very well in was film studies and film business.
Okay.
I was a little mortified at the latter one. Got like top marks, and I was like, no, I just want to be an artist.
where did you want to go in terms of being a filmmaker? So like writing, directing, all of it?
Probably as a writer.
Hmm.
I did very well with dialogue. So a lot of the creative writing courses that I was taking, the thing that people always responded to was the fact that my dialogue was always really entertaining and very realistic. But to answer your question, the film studies professor, I took this class on, it's basically filmmakers who, throughout the course of their career, they have different tropes that they will often bring up, and similar characters or different things that you could look at and you could immediately go, ah, that's a Woody Allen film. Ah, that's a Kurosawa film. Ah, that's a Hitchcock film. I mean, you hear like a line of dialogue from a Hitchcock film and you're like, that's a Hitchcock film. So one of the filmmakers that we looked at was David Cronenberg. I'd never seen any of his films prior to this. And my mind was just blown completely open because I was never into horror films and just was utterly fascinated at how layered his films are and how incredibly smart they are as well. But at the same time, they're really gory and really wonderful. I mean, have you ever seen The Brood?
No, I've not seen The Brood.
Well, basically, he did it after his first divorce, and he there's a story of a couple breaking up, and the woman decides to manifest all of her rage about the divorce by giving birth to these little munchkins in Adidas suits. Then she sends her brood over to, like, you know, get rid of her husband, and it's just very fantastical and sort of silly, but at the same time, there's, you know, sort of that idea of physically manifesting emotion, which is a bit more highbrow.
Got it. That's super interesting stuff. So, and where were you studying in Australia? Like, how come, like, was it just an opportunity came around randomly to go over there, or?
Well, I really wanted to move to Europe. I had no interest in living in the States and was just utterly fascinated at the idea of having so much more history and beautiful architecture and all that sort of stuff. But the college that I went to, Washington College, didn't have an exchange program where I could go to a European university and study film.
Right.
And the only university that they had on a very short list was Bond University, which is on the Gold Coast in Australia, which, as I've told many people, it's like a culture-free zone. It's just like ocean, sand, high rises. But they have a really good film program. So I went over there for a year to do that.
Great. And then did you hop over to New Zealand from there, or like back to the States, or how did that go?
I had to go back to the States to finish up my undergrad and, you know, write that thesis. And then I really had an interest in continuing my education. I enjoyed writing a great deal. I felt like with my thesis that I was only really starting to scratch the surface of what was truly out there in terms of figuring out this whole, you know, like feminism in film. And I knew that there was a lot there, but I just didn't have access to it or direction. So I ended up finding that the University of Auckland had an amazing film studies program. And applied, got in, and was on a plane within a matter of weeks after graduating.
Wow. And is that – so I understand there was something to do with, like, relationships and the way they were portrayed in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, according to something I read.
That's my master's.
I was like, that sounds amazing. I thought it was a really interesting topic. I mean, which we just very briefly mentioned before we started recording, but, like, the interest in pop culture – which I have as well on many different levels. So, like, reading that kind of, I mean, I love that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it'd be great. You know, how did you come up with that one?
I think I was, so I think that probably the first odd year that I was at University of Auckland, I took a lot of different classes, including there was a porn theory class, which.
Porn theory?
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay.
Which kind of afforded me really funny conversations for the next 10 years.
I mean, I'm going to have to ask you about porn theory. Is it like recipes for, like, this is should be shot this way and this kind of exposition? Yeah. Or?
Yeah. Just really likening the fact that in a lot of ways, porn films are very similar to musicals and that there's certain things that have to happen. Yeah. characters will go through certain situations and all of the above.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, ultimately,
there's a formula to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lots of tropes that are evident, whether the filmmaker realizes it or not, that they're putting them in there.
Yeah.
Feminist film theory classes, probably took a producing class. And I think there was, I started to get more interested in not necessarily, and this is one thing that I've noticed, that I've met quite a few strategists that used to be filmmakers, in that you're really interested in what people are showing you, but not telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're enthusiastically nodding. Yes. And I think that that's what makes people who are so into film or have been filmmakers really fantastic strategists, because you're not taking anything at face value. You're really looking below that surface. And a lot of strategists that I really enjoy talking with, they haven't done strategy their entire career. They've done film. They have been artists. They've traveled a lot. They have just this inherent interest in culture itself and pop culture, reading and all that sort of thing. And I was chatting with another friend of mine about it the other day, who's also a strategist, and she got very excited.
I get excited about people and culture, generally speaking. Anyhow, it's part of the reason why I love having these conversations in the first place.
Yeah. Which totally makes sense. And like when I found out more about your podcast, I was like, how had this not existed before?
Really? Well, it took me a while to figure out the, I can't remember if I've talked about this in any other episode before, but I might have. But I was trying to figure out what my show would be about. And I had this very fancy idea of trying to do a simile mock focus group where I'm talking to real people about different themes. So let's say, gather a group of people to talk about cars and what they really know about it. So different, stuff that people buy, with the idea that, potential clients, brand managers would be interested in this type of stuff. Plus anybody would. And then I quickly realized that it was a logistical nightmare to try to organize conversations with three or four people at a time, plus making sure that they would be interesting people to talk to and have the kind of ideal conversations that would be super interesting in my mind. And I gave up on that particular idea. And then I was just coming up with recurring advice that you see from people on, anytime, any type of content, whether it's writing a blog or doing a podcast or doing a video show. Find something that you're really interested in, that you're naturally interested in, that you're going to be doing for yourself, whatever, regardless of the amount of people that listen to it or not, because basically you can plan on not many people listening, so you better do it for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it took me several months to figure out, to come back to the easiest answer. It's always takes the longest time to find the simplest answer. And I was like, I'm a strategist. I like talking about strategy. What about, and I'm also into gaming and I like talking about that kind of stuff. So basically I took my main interest and I'm like, all right, this is an excuse to go and talk to people that I'm interested in talking to, which I would also do naturally because I'm naturally getting in touch with a lot of people, whether it's via Twitter, via whatever, asking them to meet for coffee. And while a lot of people are interested in meeting for coffee or having a chat, a lot of other people are like, well, that's great, but I'm busy. So, what's the interest? So I'm inviting people to come and participate in the podcast. So it's useful for everyone. That's the idea, basically.
That's a great one. It's a really, really good one. Yeah. Cause I love having an excuse. And that's part of the great thing about the Slack group is giving me an excuse to talk with a lot of really, really extraordinary women who are also sort of like, this is a great excuse to talk with other ladies.
Yeah, I'm sure. Cool. All right. So how did you, you finished your film studies. So where did you go from there? What did you have in mind? And how did you make it into the link between strategy? Because that doesn't come immediately, does it?
I've had kind of three different careers.
Yeah.
So I just realized that I never answered your question about Buffy. Leading on from the feminist film theory, and also did a reality TV theory class as well, which is a whole other conversation. But I had gotten into Buffy. I saw that there were a lot of layers there. And then specifically with season four, I saw that they had their first gay relationship on the show. And Joss Whedon's hands were very much tied in that he couldn't show that these two women had a relationship in the usual ways that people show that they're in a relationship on a show, like holding hands, kissing, all that sort of stuff. So he had to get much more creative in demonstrating that they had a relationship and that it was a good relationship. Meanwhile, at the same time, Buffy has this relationship with this kind of army guy, and it's a pretty lousy relationship. But they were still showing that they were in a relationship in this sort of traditional way. So I thought it was really fascinating juxtaposing these two different relationships and how much stronger the lesbian relationship came out in The Wash as opposed to the straight relationship. And I thought that that warranted a lot of discussion, which I think it did. And then I'm just going to talk for a second about the other bit of my thesis, which I only recently put together. So when I sort of look back on my career, advertising seemingly comes out of the blue, except this one paper I wrote when I was doing my master's. And it was part of a six-parter, which comprised my thesis. And one of them was on Back to the Future and what makes it an inherently American film. Because, you know, you can watch a lot of different films, and whether there's, no matter whether you jump in for a couple minutes, sometimes, you know, if you watch a lot of cinema, then you kind of go, oh, this is a French film or this is a Danish film or whatever. But I was really, really interested to discover what makes something an inherently American film. And the great thing, the conclusion I came to was brands.
Right.
So the brands demonstrate that Marty goes from like the 80s to the 50s to the, was it like 2000s or something like that, and kind of back again. And it's really, although it's obviously the set pieces and the environment, it's the brands that he interacts with that are things that people are so fond of, like with Pepsi at Comic-Con last year.
Yeah.
They had DeLorean and two lookalikes. Yes. And everything. So,
That's fascinating. Did you watch Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip?
No, I haven't.
So that's the I'm trying to remember. Did you watch The West Wing?
No, I haven't. That's one of the few shows. Yeah, I feel like it's going to be a hell of a commitment. So I'm like kind of going, the next time that I have a really bad tummy bug, then
it's definitely worth watching. It still holds together. It's still amazing. But I'm trying to remember the name of the writer, and I can't remember his name right now, but we all know it. It'll come back to me. Anyhow, the show he did straight after The West Wing is called the Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, and there was only one season of it, unfortunately, but I thought it was still really good. And it was the behind the scenes of a comedy show that takes place in Los Angeles. And one of the episodes is all about the fact that, you know, they're running out of money, and the producers trying to tell them, you're going to have to take sponsors, and the creators and the runners of the show are like, no, it's not out of the question. We've been in this studio that's historic for like 60 years, it's not possible. Until they have this conversation about brands, and they're like, we're on the Sunset Strip, we're right in Hollywood. Actually, what if we embrace that and integrate all the brands as part of it? So they make the background of their stage to look like the billboards that are all around them in Hollywood. So they put a bit of meta advertising in there.
Is it Aaron Sorkin?
Aaron Sorkin. Yes. Thank you so much. It is Aaron Sorkin.
Yes. Oh, that's really clever. I find it endlessly fascinating of how, yeah, you know, just product placement and that sort of thing, and how it just completely removes you from the movie to a laughable degree. I mean, some of the big blockbusters, you know, they open up their HP laptop.
Yes, absolutely. Some of it is not particularly well like thought through, integrated. But I mean, in that perspective, I was just listening to a TED Radio Hour with the excerpt from Morgan Spurlock of The Greatest Movie Ever Sold. Yep. That was a fantastic movie. It was equal parts genius, terrifying, and sometimes wondering a little bit what I'm up to in the job of advertising, but also very, very good movie. Yeah.
I was really lucky in Auckland. He actually came and presented the film.
Oh, really?
And, wow. Yeah, wore the suit with all the – and it's crazy because Sheets – it was one of the, was the first sponsor who signed on. And they're a sort of a gas and convenience store chain in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And they started out in central PA where I'm from. So I stood up and I asked him a question. I was like, Sheetz? And he was like, Sheetz! They were totally into it. But he was very impressed that I knew who it was, like in the middle of New Zealand.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah. But, and, you know, we started buying Palm after we saw that movie, and we always have it in the fridge now. So.
Oh, really? I've actually not, I still haven't drunk that. I've never tried it. Never tried it.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Okay. Is it wonderful?
Yeah, it is pretty wonderful. It's also great as a mixer.
That's good to know. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So, let's get back to where you, so you had, you said you had three main careers, basically.
Yeah. So I finished up my MA and I had this idea that I should work in TV, and, I was working at a really, really cool bar in Auckland and had worked there for a couple years while I was doing my master's. It's called The Wine Cellar. If you ever find yourself in Auckland, New Zealand, go there, say hello to Rowan, who will be behind the bar, and tell him that Kim sent you. And he'll be like, what? But it's a really, really cool bar and has a great atmosphere about it. And I was starting to do some just exhibitions just because I was working there and I knew a lot of artists. So started arranging these exhibitions. And one of the artists in an exhibition was a guy named Pete, and I'm going to completely forget his last name. But he was enormously talented and American. And it turned out that we'd come to New Zealand on the same day, different flight.
That's funny.
Many, like a couple years before. Okay. And he said, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I got this idea. I should work in TV. And he's like, I work at Sky TV Network. He's just like, give me your resume. I'll get it in and bring you around, introduce you to some people.
Yeah.
So long story short, I ended up working in TV for 5 years.
Fantastic.
As an editor. And then I started doing a little bit of producing before I left.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. It was in sports, so lots of rugby and cricket and sports, which I still don't entirely understand, but I was editing.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so I worked in TV for 5 years, and then I saw that social media was really going to blow up at that stage. It hadn't quite blown up, but I could see the potential in it.
Were you pretty active already on social media then? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very much so. And as the TV work was winding down, I was getting really bored. And my husband at some stage just was like, why don't you do something with being online? You do that all the time. You really seem to enjoy it. You love connecting with people. Like, why don't you just do that? And I was like, I guess I could maybe do that. So I've always had a really strong background as a writer, and it's gotten my foot in the door in a lot of different types of jobs. And as it so happened, I managed to get my foot in the door with a very big travel website and travel publishing company. They put out books as well as a huge website because I could take over as their editor and put together a book on road tripping around New Zealand, and spent a really enjoyable 6 months working there.
Yeah.
And so I ended up working in marketing and online marketing for a number of years, worked for the New Zealand government, for a government agency that helps New Zealand businesses do business abroad, produced a lot of thought leadership videos, of which you can still see online.
Great.
I got to interview some really cool people. And then
how did you find like what was most useful in terms of, you know, strengths or transferable skills between from going to the TV editing and producing to working on marketing and social media projects?
It's all about storytelling.
Yeah.
It's always all about storytelling and how to communicate with people.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of the beginning, middle, and end of it.
Which I guess that's the thread then for you all across. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, from being able to tell a story and do that visually in TV to being able to communicate that story in an effective manner with marketing and understanding that audience better. and then moving into strategy, and which is really a hybrid of those two things, yeah, and being able to do it in an effective way.
Yeah. Fantastic. Cool. And so, and then from there into, I guess, strategy, right?
Or... Yeah. Well, I worked with startups for a little while. I was a marketing consultant, and I was a VP of marketing at a streaming media startup that was based in the middle of nowhere, New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Their offices were the oldest cheese factory in New Zealand.
Sounds like an amazing location, though.
Yeah, it was. It was just cold. Very damp. But I did that for a couple of years and moved over to New York. My husband is Kiwi and absolutely loves America. Yeah. And we'd been over here a few times, fell in love with the place, and then decided to move over and moved over here, tried to get work in other startups, wasn't really enthused about the offers that I did have. Lots of people asking for free work.
Sure.
Lots of, yeah.
Which there's, yeah, we'll come back to that one. Well, actually, what do you think about that? Because that seems to be like one of the things that's, I would say, plaguing our industry and our jobs in particular.
Yeah.
And like the main currency of any kind of job is free, which.
Yeah. It's bananas. It's totally bananas. I mean, this is, I just got tired of people being so blatant in their job applications. Like I think the, one of the last ones that I even responded to was someone asking for an entire marketing plan.
Yeah.
And that was even before the first interview.
Yeah, sure.
And I just was like, are you joking? Yes. Are you taking a psychotropic substance?
Yes.
I mean, that's just preposterous to me. I mean, why on earth? And the thing is that it really screws up your relationship with a potential employer or a potential client.
Yes.
From the get-go, they don't value what you do. And yes. Yeah. But what do you think about it?
I think the same. I think it's very, very tough. I mean, from my perspective, and when I was freelancing until very recently, I had the similar experience, you know, earlier this year of, you know, somebody inviting me to a meeting for a freelance piece of work. And, oh, we have this amazing opportunity with this client, da da da. I'm like, great. Sounds really interesting. Say, like, oh, you know, we think we should be doing this and this. I'm like, the brief is not very clear, but you know, if you want me to do research this and this, as you said, no problem. You know, these are my rates. Oh, but you know, don't you ever work on spec projects for, I was like, oh, I'm really, really sorry, but I don't tend to work for free, basically. So, yeah. You know, it's like, I think it sounds like your brief from your client is not clear in the first place. She was like, oh, but would you be able to put some quick questions together? I'm like, listen, I could tell you the quick questions right now. You know, go and ask your clients this and this and this question because your brief is not clear. Now, if you want me to do research based on the unclarity of your thing, then you pay me my fees and that I'm happy to do whatever research you want. And I don't think that's what you need. I mean, I think you need to go and talk to your client, figure things out.
Yep.
And then come back to me that's another interesting problem, which is not asking the right kind of questions in the first place, including how much money do you have?
Yep.
And then laying the problem on somebody else and trying to get the work for free. It's really difficult because it happens. I mean, it seems to happen at the highest level. I mean, you look at and I don't know how that happened. And this is really big business consolidation, but the McDonald's changed from Leo Burnett over to Omnicom recently. And the apparent rumors or news saying that, you know, whoever was going to win is going to work at cost with a profit sharing. I don't know. You hadn't heard of that?
No, I hadn't. But I read, I think it was in Ad Age a couple months ago, that in comparison to the 60s, I think it was like on Mad Men or something like that, that advertising agencies are working with 20% fewer staff and are expected to produce 30% more material.
Yes. I hadn't seen that particular statistic, but... It's really difficult. It's really difficult. And I don't know how you're finding it now as a freelancer, but like the last, you know, earlier this year and last year, I found it increasingly difficult to find, you know, great partners to work with in terms of great employers to work with who appreciated the quality of the work and appreciated that it was worth paying for, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. Total sense. I mean, and there's another thing that I've been thinking about a great deal lately is that idea, and this is a much bigger sort of strain, is that strategy in and of itself, you know, sometimes a client will come and they'll be like, okay, we're launching this product. Mm. We need you to come up with a campaign. And as a strategist, you're looking at it going, well, okay, so do you want me to do some segmentation research? Do you want me to make sure that people are interested in this, that, you know, you've done it? No. We just want a campaign. And ultimately, you can really be put on the back foot when, in fact, you need strategy much earlier on. Otherwise, you're really just justifying the advertising agency just selling advertising, and advertising may not be the answer to their problem.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, agencies have been a few places that I've worked at where I'm just kind of going like, you're getting them to spend this millions of dollars on this campaign, but it's not actually solving the problem that they've tasked us with doing, but it means you can bill more. Like that's, yeah.
It's part of the very interesting conundrums that the business is built in. Their models are built around certain kinds of business, and mm-hmm. it's self-perpetuating until the model might collapse. And that's what everybody's talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, the media models, the film industry collapsing, the music industry collapsing. I read a friend of mine, another who works in this kind of industry as well, was posting something about a Danish startup expanding across Europe and ready to disrupt the media agency industry. They are basically a startup that is, you can buy media from them and you buy based on a monthly subscription and there's no markup. So you pay a monthly subscription, you organize your media, and you get exactly the transparency what the media costs. So that model is, you know, if it grows, and there's all the chances in the world for it to grow, mm-hmm. would very quickly replace the model of media agencies buying and making a markup over the rest of the media. And equally, I don't know how quickly, because there's a huge industry that's set up this way and it's probably going to stay this way. And it's really interesting because everybody's talking about disruption. A lot of things are moving much faster and a lot of things are difficult to keep up with. Consolidation happening and everything we're just talking about in the advertising industry. There's still mm-hmm. a need for advertising. There's still a need for promotion. There's still a need for communications. But it's just don't really know what things are going to be looking like. And it's equally difficult to figure out like which skills and which knowledge we should be focusing on as strategists, because the increasing amounts of knowledge and increasing amounts of platforms, increasing amounts of, and sometimes I'm feeling like, and this is difficult and horrible to admit, but like I'm getting older. I don't really understand anymore. Younger generations are doing.
Different channels are popping up like crazy, yes. And where to meet people in the right place at the right time. I think that's sort of the nature of the business. I think everyone, whether they want to admit it or not, feels the same way.
Yeah. But and equally at the same time, not to be entirely just a grumpy old pessimist, it's part of the reason I still love it, and it's part of the reason I just was like I dove into digital channels very early on, and that I really love the richness of it. I love how varied it is, and I love how complicated and complex it is, and I love the crazy stuff that people are doing with it. And sometimes it's difficult to understand and get to like, all right, so I know what all the kids are doing. I know all these people are doing, expressing themselves using, you know, blogs and videos and YouTube and everything else. Now how brands should be using it sometimes gets a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I am a huge believer in getting, you know, information about culture as a whole and mm-hmm. news as a whole, not just from one or two websites or from mm-hmm. Facebook. I have an enormous amount of, I'm looking at the stack over here, of magazine subscriptions.
Yeah.
And I subscribe to the New York Times on the weekends, and I'm really, really, really adamant that I am going to get my information from as many different places as possible. Mm. I think there's something inherently flawed of opening up Facebook newsfeed and just seeing a bunch of articles you already agree with.
Yeah.
Because it's not helping you at all. It's not getting any kind of viewpoint other than your own.
Where else do you go out there for looking for, I don't know, hints, culture?
Best Magazine. I recently changed over from, I canceled my Rolling Stone subscription because I was at a stage where I do this thing. This is sort of like another bit of a glimmer of how I got into strategy. Because when I tell people that I do this, they're like, God, you're such a strategist. Where I started doing this in New Zealand because there was a kind of Kiwi business magazine that kind of deals with innovation and tech and that sort of thing. And I started looking through it and doing a percentage of how many women were depicted in the magazine versus how many men were depicted in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And the editor at the time followed me on Twitter. And so I just would send her these like missives of just like 13% this month. Come on, you can do better than that.
That's awesome.
And she'd always be like, I'm trying.
Yeah.
But I just got to the stage looking at Rolling Stone. Although I was getting great information, I was also being very, very frustrated that they just won't put a woman on the cover unless she's not wearing a bra or a Stevie Nicks. And I think that the imagery was really, really chasing me off, and the fact that they don't report on very many women bands. They don't report on very many women solo artists. And at one stage I was looking at this and I was just like, this is not speaking to me anymore. Mm. It's just not. So I canceled that and I got a subscription to Bust and got my first issue with Tina Fey on the cover and went through it, and they have a great,
so I've not heard of Bust. So what is the, how do they talk about themselves as a magazine, I guess? Or how would you talk about it?
Cool. I would talk about it along the lines of they have great interviews with smart women. They ask them great questions. They have a lot of, they still have products and advertising, but it's not, it's the advertising is usually of the product or women in the product, but it's not, objectifying them.
Mm.
I'm just kind of looking through it right now. Like, they have a bunch of podcasts you should check out, books you should check out. They have a great, great interview with Iggy Pop and, Josh Homme, which I was really excited about. Like, genuinely, I like both of them, especially Josh Homme.
Yeah.
But I really like the fact that although there's some articles that may get into like how to make a printed towel or something like that, I'm not interested in that. But I like the fact that they have it. And they had a whole section on indie weddings of how to do it yourself. And most of my women friends who know me know that I'm just utterly befuddled at the even concept of a wedding. We did not have one. But I like that it's there. And I like that they're presenting different ways of thinking and doing, and that both men and women are depicted. And I started picking them up from the newsstand and leafing through them and just kind of head nodding vigorously. And even if it was something, I mean, that's one of the great things about the New York Times or really any printed material.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about clickbait. And so you might find yourself reading an article about, I don't know, yesterday there was a great article about Trump supporters in Paris, Kentucky. And although I don't agree with Trump on any level, I liked the fact that there was an in-depth article that explained why these people are supporting him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's just something I didn't know and I was really struggling to understand. And so even though I disagree with them, I now have a better understanding of how they're justifying supporting Trump.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It was really, really interesting. Cool. All right. So now that you're freelancing as a strategist in New York, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And do you tend to work across the board for agencies or directly with clients or a bit of everything, whatever comes up? Or would you say you have some kind of specialty?
Probably brand strategy.
Yeah.
I think where I'm the most effective by far is being able to work with a client to really figure out who they are, what they're about, kind of what that vision statement is, what that manifesto is, and then not only kind of coming up with these high level ideas and of who they are, what they're about, but then being able to work with them and say, that's all well and good, but now we need to come up with a way to communicate that and how this looks. And it's all well and good to say that you care about the environment. We need to show how you care about the environment. And these are the right channels to, that we need to get this message across to. These are the people that would probably be most receptive to your message that you want to get in front of. And this is the story that we need to tell. Okay. And yeah, so that's probably where and those are the projects that I really like the most.
Great. Brilliant. And they can find you on, we'll come back to that actually. Let's see. I think there is, we're going to start wrapping up and, usually I finish with those cool down questions. One of them okay. being an ice cream related question. So I need to spend a little bit more time finding the wacky ones, but let's just start with a normal, you know, if you go for ice cream, what kind of flavor would you go for?
Fish food from Tom and Jerry's.
Very good. Good one.
There's no other superior or, uh-huh. or. Superiority Burger in
I don't know that one.
Oh, they're in New York. They it's a vegan place. I eat a lot of I'm not vegan myself.
Okay.
But I eat a lot of vegan food. I just think okay. it's delicious. But they New York Magazine actually listed them as the number one ice cream place
so
in New York.
So is it coconut milk base or
I have no idea.
Usually vegan ice cream is usually coconut based.
I have no idea what they put in there, but they have new flavors every day. You get two flavors in one small cup, okay. and they have the most extraordinary, mind-blowing flavors that you would never think that you would like.
Oh, really? Do you remember one as an example?
There was a black sesame and...
I think somebody told me about that.
Mango chili.
Mango chili.
Yeah.
Wow. Sounds
they,
impressive.
I mean... This the flavors that they have, it's gotten to a stage like, you know, when you really like an actor yeah. and so you're at the stage like, okay, you know, Jeff Goldblum, he's great. I'm going to see the next three films that he's in because yeah. he was so good in Jurassic Park. I'm at that stage with Superiority where I'm like, it doesn't matter what they've concocted or whether I like that vegetable or I like that flavor.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy the next three things that they come out yeah. with. I just inherently trust them. They're so good.
Cool. All right. Well, here's one for you, actually. Given the interest in cinema and movies, do you remember a scene in a movie where there was a particular, well, I mean, memorable representation or somebody eating ice cream or representation of ice cream?
Jurassic Park.
It's true.
You know, when they're talking about, like, in Laura Dern and, like, yes. you know, it's the guy who owns the park.
It's Sam Neill. No, the guy who owns the park is not not Sam Neill's park coach. I can't remember.
But yeah, he when they're eating these huge tubs of ice cream because they're melting.
Yes, that's right.
Like, it's just the illusion of control. You can't actually control nature.
That's
that was lucky.
I'm very excited. I'm soon going to be there's a Royal Philharmonic Orchestra concert with John Williams presenting all the best favorites of John Williams at the Royal Albert Hall in London in a few weeks.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so
I mean, it probably will have happened by the time this is published, but there's a Jurassic Park link I'm very, very excited about. They're going to be playing all the favorites. So some Star Wars, some Jurassic Park, Harry Potter, like all the big John Williams scores.
Oh, I want to go to there.
I think it's going to be amazing. Really looking forward to it.
Oh, that sounds incredible. I'm so jealous. You're going to have such a fabulous time.
Yeah. Let's see what else. So as you know, I mean, you might have heard from a few of the conversations on the podcast. Another one of my interests is around gaming. And mm-hmm. And I know, well, I don't know. Do you have any interest in gaming of any kind? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not like hardcore or anything like that, but excuse me.
That's okay.
Super Mario 2. Just clocked it. And I'm really good at Mario Kart. And for whatever reason, just I was always playing Super Mario when I was a kid. So
sure.
I'm just really, really good at it. I was just at the Nintendo store last week.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Were you excited about... So, of course, the iPhone 7 was just announced with the Nintendo tie-ups. With Mario that's going to be in the iPhone 7, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
is that
Mario
it?
Run or something along those lines.
Yes, there's going to be a endless running version of a Mario game on it that's coming within the iPhone, which, what do you think of that?
When you bring it back to branding, I have been very fascinated with Nintendo lately.
Yes.
The fact that in November that they've got their tiny little mini original Nintendo coming out. It's a console that has 30 of their original Nintendo games already preloaded onto it.
Yeah.
Want one so bad.
Yeah, I do want, I want one of those too.
And they're going to be $30. Those things are going to sell like hotcakes.
They will. Just like, well, people like us that are like looking for the nostalgia of their childhood, for sure. Yeah.
And I really like that they're leaning back into the nostalgia thing. I think it's really, really smart that Pokemon, I think, has been a much bigger hit than they were anticipating. And I think that that really comes across with how slow their iterations have been.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that they did, you know, create this partnership with Apple with the idea that it's going to get a whole other generation back into it.
Yeah.
I think that they make some incredibly clever games. I love the puzzle games. I think Zelda and the Ocarina of Time.
Mm.
I played a little bit and enormously enjoyed. And it's just like, it's those games that, I'm a huge Professor Layton fan.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with this game?
A little bit. I only played a few times, like on somebody else's game, like ages ago. But for everybody's benefit, why not explain what it is?
So Professor Layton is a character. I think he was a cartoon first, but he solves puzzles. And he's an archaeology professor or something along those lines in Japan. Or maybe he's in London, but it has a Japanese anime theme to it. And he has a little assistant who's like a young sprightly boy with a very terrible fake accent. He's just like, "That's right, governor." And there's a series of these games. They're puzzle games. They are incredibly fun. I mean, they are just, they take you to these different little towns, and you have interactions with these characters who are like, "Oh no, I can't find my 5 golden rings." And then it takes you into a puzzle that you have to find 5 golden rings, you know, in either a word puzzle or something along those lines. But they really get your brain moving in different ways. And they're also very entertaining and they're quite cute. I think I've gone through about 4 or 5 of them, but, they're really, really fun. You know, if you have a 3D or 3DS, like, you should totally check it out.
Cool. Brilliant. Okay, last one. What have you seen at the cinema recently that you particularly recommend to the audience?
Oh.
Best movie recently.
Best movie. I went to go see Ghostbusters on principle, and I enjoyed it. But I wouldn't say that it's something that everyone should be rushing out to see.
Yeah.
I'm very, very lucky. Part of the reason why we live in New York is because there's so many different things you can do here that you can't really do anywhere else. There's a number of different cinemas where they play old movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 3 that actually will serve you a nice meal as you're watching your movie.
Yeah, which is great.
Oh, it's amazing. And we went to the Nighthawk Cinema a couple of weeks ago and we saw Punch Drunk Love,
A.T.
Anderson film. And I was so, so into that movie and wrote papers about it. And when it came out, it was just one of those first films that for me, it was recognizing that there was so much underneath the layers and so much going on frame by frame that wasn't being told but shown to me. And my husband had never seen it before. And we've been on this huge P.T. Anderson kick lately, rewatching all of his films. So to be actually able to see it in film, like film stock, with really delicious hummus.
Awesome.
And raw veggies. It was just probably one of the best cinematic experiences I've had.
Fantastic. All right. So for people in New York, that's playing on a regular basis, or, I mean, you can just rent Punch Drunk Love if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it. Awesome.
Yeah. And the score is by John Brion, and he nails it. It's just perfect.
I've seen it a while back. So, I mean, it'd be nice to watch it again, actually. I've seen it just a long time ago. Okay, cool. So, I mean, we're going to wrap up. Where can people find you? Are you speaking anytime soon? What's the best place to get in touch if ever somebody's looking for a strategist? Or
Probably either through my LinkedIn page or...
And I'll add all the links in the show notes, like to your Twitter and your LinkedIn and everything else.
Otherwise, I was like, do I spell it out?
Well, you can spell it out if you wish,
Oh, no. It's the link will be when it's posted, but it is kimbklyn.com, so Kim Brooklyn. I'm sort of in talks to do a strategist talk, actually, a panel with Ladies Get Paid, which is that other Slack group.
Okay, cool.
Evidently, there's been a lot of women who are like, I don't understand what a strategist is, but I think I might be one. So they really want to have some sort of place where they can do Q&A with a couple of strategists that I'm going to put together. But that's
fantastic. Me. Well, thank you very much for your time. It was brilliant talking to you. It was a pleasure. Yeah. And we'll see you around on Twitter and maybe in person. But the next time I'll visit New York, we'll find out. We'll see.
Oh, that would be brilliant. Cool.
I don't know when that is, by the way. I'm just making that up.
Well, I've been meaning to get over to London for a while. I have quite a few.
Well, hey, same thing. If you come over to London, like, hit me up. It's fine. No problem.
Oh, cool. Cool. All right. Fantastic. Well, have a good evening. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Here we go. Another episode gone and done already of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. If you're listening so far, I'm guessing you've enjoyed it. Wasn't it a great conversation? Kim's great. Really had a lot of fun talking with her. Now, we have a few more episodes coming up, and the next one probably in a couple of weeks. Don't forget, you can sign up to the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter as well that I published, well, guess what, every Sunday. Just a bunch of like fun, a bit of an update about what's going on with me, some interesting links to articles that I've read, a funny GIF. There's a variety of different things in there. I shortened it up. It used to be a very long-form thing, but again, similarly to my just reducing the volume of publication, given I have a pretty, well, more demanding day job right now, I've been just looking at how I can write the newsletter a little bit faster. And also making sections, like a lot of people gave me really great feedback of the different sections I have, like different sections about what's going on in the news, what's going on in gaming, what's going on in the communications industry, etc. So, yeah, check it out. You can find out the rest of the archives and the rest of the podcast episodes on my website. That's icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, www.icecreamforeveryone.net. And I believe that's about it for now. Well, have a fantastic afternoon, evening, morning, whatever time it is for you. Bye.